by your program organizer, Richard Perry, who expressed a conviction that, and I quote, recordings are cultural artifacts and are as significant culturally, historically, and intellectually as books, as well as being entertaining, end of quote, to which I add, hopefully. These concepts have long been held by me to be self-evident, and my two previous presentations to ASK, the technical and subjective replication of archival sound given at Chapel Hill in 1981, and the castrato, countertenor, and male alto voices given at Bowling Green in 1984, were aimed at establishing archival truth as far as is possible by using an amalgam of both technical expertise and informed human subjectivity. I would hope you will agree that a digitalized Abraham Lincoln, for instance, one of my heroes, when reconstituted as a whole again, might very well result in a sum of the parts that lack the special spark that made him unique. So it is, I claim, with performance of every type and kind. In view of the suggested theme that this conference should embrace, I would ask for your indulgence if, for the first few minutes of this presentation, I touch on matters that may not seem directly relevant to Lieré and his cylinders, the central subject of my paper. However, at the end of those few minutes, I hope you will agree on the relevance of this preamble, so here goes. At Bowling Green, I played a recording of Professor Alessandro Moreschi, the last Sistine Chapel castrato, coming off an original acoustic disc, and I won't inflict that on you again. Pleasure. You ain't heard nothing yet. A sound likened by Desmond Shaw Taylor, mentioned by our distinguished opener this morning, by the way, more to a yodel than a voice. Your sometime president, David Hall, however, having heard part of the interview I recorded with Moreschi's pupil, Professor Domenico Mancini, also of the Sistine Chapel, recalled that in the part of the interview, Mancini had said of his master that in the vast acoustic of St. Peter's in Rome, he was indescrivibile, indescribable, and that for the first time, the contemporary claims of Moreschi as the Angelo del Vaticano and the Angelo di Roma began to make sense. Following on from this keen perception of David Hall, my good friend Peter Cox added some appropriate reverb, so that Moreschi now sounds like this. Up a lot more, bring him up. Up, up. That's it. Well, not exactly the mellifluousness of a Gili or a Tagliavini, but a voice that was obviously disfigured by the acoustic recording horn, and with many of those disfigurements removed by an acoustic that was its obvious and essential habitat. I think, too, that for the first time, certain qualities of the voice become evident, and it is possible to discern some of the reasons why, in his lifetime, Moreschi received the accolades he did. Perhaps, too, his particular and peculiar technique was specially employed to cut through and deal with an acoustic of vast proportions and with a considerable inherent time delay. I hope that that demonstration underlines the dangers of reconstituting a performance that has been subject to a straight or a flat dub, whatever that may mean, when both concepts would obviously and merely perpetuate what is at best an unlovely and unauthentic sound at odds with the actuality and contemporary evaluation. In this connection, it is perhaps pertinent to mention the work of Robert Parker of Australia and his astonishing work on the retrieval of early jazz recordings. These are so remarkable for the BBC to recommend to listeners the use of VHF FM, a prerequisite it doesn't normally use for any other of its radio transmissions. I cannot recommend these recordings issued on BBC LPs and cassettes too highly. I touch next on another aspect of archival veracity, and one that caused me special difficulty in the appraisal and realizing of Lyre cylinders: speed of play. In illustration of the problem, here is the same take of Pagan Love Song coming off both a Hillandale Edison Diamond disc, 52639R, and an Edison Lateral, 14051, both, of course, electrically recorded. The vocal section from the two separate discs, one Hillandale and the other Lateral, has been butt joined, and no doubt you will notice the changeover point. Walter Scanlon is the vocalist. So there you have the same original performance sounding differently, and only matched up speed-wise by rotating the diamond disc not at its established speed of 80 RPM, but at 81.4 RPM, to match the published speed of the Edison laterals of 78.8. Conversely, to match the diamond disc at 80 RPM, it was necessary to revolve its lateral equivalent at 77.4 RPM. Here again, I'm indebted to Peter Cox's great skill and patience in marrying up those two different format of discs. Finally, in laying the ground for my appraisal of Lyre cylinders, here is my electrical realization of part of a giant-size Edison kinetophone used in Edison's ill-fated attempt to achieve lip-sync sound with cinefilm. The illustrations of the kinetophone cylinder I have used also show the normal size blue ambrol for comparison purposes. The only reference I have seen as to speed of revolve of these cylinders gives it as 120 RPM. But to achieve something approaching naturalness, I have subjectively rotated the kinetophone cylinder at 100 RPM. This speed of revolve also then provides a reasonable equation that relates to the 400 feet of film used in the kinetophone system and running at 16 or 18 frames per second. Although I have segued just some of the audio elements encapsulated on the kinetophone cylinder, starting with a clapperboard, I've let the interlocutor run at full length, since I maintain that he illustrates the basic theme of this conference. That is, he illustrates that recordings are as significant historically and intellectually as books, if not more so. Where the 500-year-old Gutenberg printed and mute method of communication lacks the manner of saying, which can often directly contradict word content, these same words, when contemporary life is breathed into them, have an added and essential dimension bestowed on them, even if here, in the example that follows, it is in the manner of a verbal cartoonist or even a Norman Rockwell illustration.
William Jennings Bryan, 316 to London, 3 to 1. Now he
I hope those sound illustrations demonstrate the difficulty of realizing early sound material authentically, even when the factors relating to its replay are seemingly known and accepted. You will, therefore, understand the trepidation with which I approached an appreciation of Lire and his cylinders. Not least of the difficulties in any appraisal of these cylinders is their rarity. Could I therefore ask this audience, containing, as I know it does, some of this country's most noted collectors, which of them has all four sizes of Lire cylinders? And here they are. Mr. Boyle, please. Stop it there. Right. So can I have hands up for those who have the size one on the left there, with 6 10-inch inches length of grooves and playing for 30 seconds or so? Have we got any takers?
Is this an auction?
No. No, I know how many I've got here too, yes. Size two, the second from the left, with 9 10-inch inches length of grooves, playing for 1 minute. Anybody has one of those? Size three, third from the left, with grooves extending for 1 6/10 inches, playing for 2 minutes, and here is an example. And then size four on the extreme right there, with grooves extending for just over 3 inches, playing for a nominal 4 minutes. And again, here is an example, the largest size Lire cylinder. Finally, well, has anybody got any of these, I should ask? They're not here in dozens, apparently. You like the bosom shot, yes. Well, I think you will appreciate from that response that I was in pretty unknown country, so perhaps an illustration of a Lire machine, which I hope is going to come up next, and with the rarest and largest of the Lire cylinders on its mandrel, might be useful. Mr. Beale, please. No, try again. Good, right. You can see here a Lire machine with the rarest and largest of the Lire cylinders. That's this type here. The reproduction comes from the Marty book with its superb illustrations and is to be recommended for that reason alone.
But only that reason?
That's not meant to be funny. Now, if Mr. Beale could get us back to that first illustration he had. That's it. Ah, we're there, yes. You will notice at once the anomalous appearance of the machine, a superb piece of clockwork mechanism, as to be expected from Lire, whose trade was that of a clockmaker. But strangely, with a massive and crude reproducer, culminating in what looks like, on the right there, a bent metal coat hanger, albeit tipped with a sapphire stylus, the whole propelled across a cylinder, not by a feed screw in the best approved manner, but by the grooves themselves. In other words, a floating reproducer. The progress of this floating reproducer across the cylinder and through the grooves being facilitated and indeed lubricated by the application of oil direct to the grooves. In fact, a brosse et huile spéciale pour cylindre, a brush and bottle of special oil, was available at a contemporary 2 francs for this very purpose. Now, if you would try again to see what comes up, Mike. No? No?
I'm doing it, you already have here.
That's it. That'll do. I would particularly draw your attention to the 13-pound weights replacing in this particular machine spring drive, and the considerable flywheel, many times the size of those on other cylinder machines, that is, where they even exist. Crude too, as the reproducer appears, it was one of the most expensive of the machine's components. Now, can we find the Trocadero there, Michael, somewhere? Yes. The large size of the reproducer, extending almost over the whole length of its 4-minute cylinder, the reproducer was almost that diameter, gave a loudness on replay sufficient to fill a large hall, as shown here of the Trocadero in Paris, which, as the Scientific American noted in 1897, was notorious for its poor acoustics. Lear had first become involved in the production of cylinders in 1893, in imitation of Edison's speaking doll, but by then out of production. But unlike the Edison doll, whose cylinder was of soft wax, irremovable, hand-cranked, and providing only one set piece of speech, the Lire doll, or Bébé Jumeau, to give it its French title, was equipped with a celluloid cylinder. Featured a song, was removable and exchangeable for other audio material, but most importantly, spring-driven. I therefore submit this first use of celluloid cylinders in 1893 in support of my claim for fidelity, if not of a high order, achieved by Lire well before 1900, and a decade or so before such an enduring fidelity was available elsewhere. To illustrate the point, this is all the fidelity I've been able to locate and that remains of the audio output of an Edison talking doll. Repeated twice for intelligibility purposes. It's Jack and Jill, it's not my recording. Doesn't come from me. Can you locate the doll while I'm talking, please? Right. On the other hand, survival of some sort of fidelity, again, not of a high order, is, though, still available from Lire cylinders of the type used in his all-talking, singing doll, as realized here acoustically by my good friend George Froe, using the type of mechanism employed in the Lire doll. And, of course, with the cylinder groove suitably lubricated with oil, as previously noted. And although Lire was never anachronistically able to produce a talking teddy bear, this could well have been the result. Again, an acoustic realization by George Froe. That now, lose it. the fidelity, such as it is demonstrated in those last two recordings, stems, of course, from the celluloid construction of the Lyrae cylinders. And as noted in Reed and Welsh's From Tinfoil to Stereo, because of the hardness of the celluloid, it was possible to impose more weight on the record, thus to generate more physical energy and thereby increase the volume of the reproduction. End of quote. Indeed, the Scientific American Reporter in 1897, when visiting the Lyrae works in the Rue Thibault, Paris, said of the Lyrae cylinders, or rollers, as he called them, "Monsieur Lyrae makes these of celluloid. This is an advantage, since wax rollers become soft through heat and are put out of service by a fall or almost any slight accident. With celluloid, it is possible for every roller to last a century." Well, with just 10 years to go, that claim is well on the way to being proved. The Scientific American Reporter of 1897 goes on to say, "The apparatus, it is true, is not reversible. That is to say, it is impossible, as in the old phonographs." You notice the mention there of old phonographs in 1897. "It is impossible for a person to register songs and speech for himself. The rollers have to be procured, already prepared, and none but these can be used in the apparatus. The difficulty might be overcome if the inventor desired it, but it is very evident that he does not care to do so. He prefers to sell his rollers and is thus certain they are properly registered. Upon the proper manufacture of the rollers evidently depends the success of the operation. The manufacture, moreover, is interesting. The celluloid is softened by a secret process, and then, in the form of a roller, is carried by an access to which is given an absolutely regular rotary motion produced by a dynamo. A singer places himself in front of a trumpet, which directs his voice upon the vibrating disc, of which every motion is followed by a graver. This latter penetrates the softened celluloid and produces therein depressions that are almost invisible and that will be used by the phonograph for reproduction." Well, such is the contemporary description of how a master Lyrae cylinder was recorded. As to how the softening of the celluloid cylinder was achieved to receive the recorded impressions, both From Tinfoil to Stereo and Victor Chu's talking machines attribute the softening to plunging the celluloid blank into hot water, while Daniel Marty nominates camphorated alcohol as the softening agent. Similarly, in the duplication of cylinders, celluloid blanks were again softened by whatever process, inserted into a cylindrical steel pattern, and then forced into the recorded undulations by the insertion of a mandrel inside the blank. Certainly, the quality of construction is, if that's anything to go by, the Lyrae cylinders are superb pieces of craftsmanship. This number 3 size, for instance, with grooves extending only for 1.5 inches or so, has its substantial 2 millimeter thickness of celluloid supported throughout its length and bonded to a brass sleeve insert that is further braced both in the middle and at both ends, giving a quality of roundness I've not found to be matched by any other make of cylinder. Edison himself seems to have realized the value of such internal support to the celluloid surface of his blue amberol cylinders in order to achieve the best possible degree of roundness. Indeed, I recorded an interview with an old Edison employee who told me that for special demonstrations, the old man would have precisely machined steel inserts put into blue amberols in place of the usual plaster of Paris. The improved degree of roundness achieved minimized acceleration and deacceleration of a stylus as it progressed along a groove, with a corresponding improvement in wow and flutter content. That Lyrae saw the need to obtain as near perfect a roundness in his cylinders as possible, and moreover achieved the means to do so, is, I claim, further substantiation of my claim that Lyrae did achieve fidelity, especially when fidelity embraces the permanency of celluloid, well before the turn of the century. I am reinforced in this opinion by reading in the 1986 Winter Ask newsletter that the Syracuse University's Audio Archives has recently received a substantial grant to re-record 1,500 cylinders on tape from 1890 onwards because they are deteriorating from the effects of heat and mold. I, of course, rejoice in this rescue operation, but also rejoice that Lyra's celluloid cylinders do not suffer from the faults of continuing deterioration and breakage in the way that their wax counterparts do. Moreover, in the case of the Lyra's, their permanency and fidelity will remain unimpaired for as long as can be envisaged, and certainly long after the grooves of their wax counterparts have been consumed either by wear or fungus. Further, in the case of the largest size Lyra, this number four size, the brass supporting sleeve inserts can be removed to be replaced by new, where any deformation of the original has taken place. Anyone who's tried similarly to re-sleeve, say, a blue Ambrol or other celluloid cylinders supported by metal rings at each end, with consequent subsidence of the cylinder surface in between, will appreciate the advantages offered by Lyra's. Certainly, the advantage of celluloid rollers or cylinders, noted by the far-seeing 1897 reporter of the Scientific American, is best expressed when they are realized electrically. Such an electrical realization has been made by Adrian Hindle Briscoe of the BBC Graham Library. And I used a gobbet of this French 1894 recording of the Washington Post at Chapel Hill in 1981. I was, though, at once made aware of the difficulty in establishing a proper speed of replay when band buff Fred Williams was enraged by too fast a rendering, surely underlining the need for an informed subjectivity where no documentation exists. I try now to make amends to Fred with what I hope is a more proper speed of replay. Irrespective of how correct this speed is, though, on all occasions, the band obviously consider they do a good job at all speeds, with their ecstatic reception of themselves, as you will hear at the end. This form of self-congratulation features on many Lyra cylinders and may be the first actuality of a clack in action. Only 1.5 minutes of this 2-minute cylinder could be extracted by an electrical pickup because of a raised flange on the start end, as you can see from this, and of course accounts for the particular configuration of the Lyra reproducer shown earlier. Yes? Oh, yes, forgot this bit. Yes. A size 3 Lyra celluloid realized electrically there by Adrian Hindle Briscoe. And now finally, a size 4 Lyra celluloid cylinder realized on my own latest electrical universal cylinder replay machine that can accommodate its non-standard configuration of grooves to the inch, 135 or so, and by means of this slip-on sleeve can accept the non-tapered bore of this, the largest of the Lyra cylinders. So now, in final substantiation of my claim that Lyra achieved the best and enduring fidelity demonstrable even now some 90 years on and before 1900, here is part of an English polka sung by Victor Legel. Legel was a French comique who dressed in old-style French army uniform, sang in the now long-demolished La Scala French Music Hall. It is, though, the authentic sound of an element of the French Belle Epoque of pre-1900, expressing a French cynicism of Englishmen and perhaps Americans abroad. This brings me full circle back to our organizer's brief that recordings are as significant culturally, historically, and intellectually as books, and to which this particular recording, because of the significance of its content and the excellence of its long-term longevity, adds another dimension over and above that of the mute written word. I play now only a truncated 2 minutes or so of this Lyre Cylinder, and for those of you who can only understand the few interpolated English or American words, for that matter, you may like to know the gist of what he says. Legel tells of those Britons who flocked to Paris, where they insist on speaking loudly in English wherever they go, even in the concert hall, at the ballet, and in the boutiques. On the beaches of Normandy, they band together to play English games, all the time talking loudly in their native tongue. The refrain is, "Here come the English, how, yes, very well." And "very well," I maintain, is what Lyre obtained in full measure in achieving the best of enduring fidelity of all cylinder manufacturers before 1900. I play the cylinder and I rest my case. You've got your money's worth here. Thank you very much. Thank you, Lloyd. My thanks to Deloitte Stickles and Mr. Boyle.
The Library of Congress is doing a study right now on blue amberols, which are possibly nitrate. There will be a report eventually in the journal. I just talked to Jerry about a half an hour ago. Also, Al Seppel gave us a little talk in San Francisco, which gave a recipe for recoring blue amberol cylinders. That might be interesting to know. Also, Leah Burgess showed me some file cards 2 days ago of some experimental celluloid cylinders that they have just found at the Edison site, which they might predate by maybe 5 or 10 years, some of them, the blue amberol. Some of them have clear celluloid, and you can see handwriting through the celluloid. So there are other interesting celluloid artifacts to
But they do play for 4 minutes, which again is unusual before 1900.
Oh, they'll be wrong.
Well,
yeah.
I tried to criticize you.
Oh, yes, we agree with you.
For bringing to us the attention.
I can see the problem, yes. I will watch them in washing up the moment I get my.
I think I bet. Thank you very much.
I'm afraid of the house blowing up or something. I'll let you watch
Moving.
Right. Meeting on site.